Hello, you're listening to Access Day special programming on CITR 101.9 FM and participating stations across Canada through the National Campus Radio Association. Access Day centers the stories and voices of people who identify as mentally or physically disabled. We've been broadcasting since 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time with voices and stories from people all across the country. And now we've got special programming from Edmonton, Alberta station CJSR. Every couple of years, of course, athletes get a little bit of spotlight from the Olympics and the Paralympics, but they don't stop training and competing then. The challenges they work through to participate aren't always glamorous. Caitlin McNabb spoke with Edmonton's Megan Shishelsky to find out more. Megan's doing research at the University of Alberta to get athletes with disabilities more involved in track and field. Enjoy.
Sport and athletics, they are deeply embedded in our culture. But have you ever thought about how disability intersects with sport and recreation? My next guest, Megan Shishelsky, has. In fact, Megan thinks about this intersection daily as a master's student in the Faculty of Kinesiology, Sport, and Recreation here at the University of Alberta. If you ever wanted to know more about therapeutic recreation, para-athletics, and disability, well, then have we got a show for you. My name is Caitlin McNabb, and I'll be your host. Come listen to my conversation with Megan.
My name is Megan Shishelsky, and I'm a grad student here at the University of Alberta, and I'm in the Faculty of Kinesiology, Sport, and Recreation. And I also have a couple jobs, so I work as a recreation therapist in the stroke outpatient unit at the Glenrose Hospital, and I'm also the head coach of the para-athletics team, which is run through the Stedward Center.
What are some good 101 facts to know about disability and disability and recreation specifically?
In general, there's many models of thought about disability or impairment. So impairment normally refers to kind of physical things. So like if you were missing a leg or an arm, that would be your impairment. And the kind of the school of thought that I study from would believe that disablement comes from more of a societal view. So if you were in a wheelchair, your impairment could be that you don't walk, but you're disabled because a lot of places are inaccessible. Specifically in sport and recreation, it's kind of a funny thing in sports that there are a lot of para-specific things that we can think of, like para-sports and ways to adapt equipment. But it's also often really hard to get involved in them. If you just go to your community gym and you happen to use a wheelchair, it could be really hard to find equipment that's accessible to you as well.
Do you think that's something that we as a society should push toward, having more equipment that's better adapted for people with various impairments?
I definitely think so. I mean, we all know that being inactive can lead to a lot of health concerns, and so that's one angle that I think is really important. People who have some type of impairment tend to be a lot more inactive or sedentary than their peers who don't have that same impairment.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the Stedward Center is?
Sure. So the Stedward Center is a completely adapted physical activity center. So it's designed specifically for people experiencing any sort of impairment. So we have a fitness center and adult programming through that. There's children programs, and then I work in the athlete side. So there's a para swim team, and I coach para athletics or track and field, as it's more commonly known.
Can you tell us a bit about your background, how you got into coaching the para-athletics?
So I used to run track. I was on the varsity U of A team for 5 years, and I also have quite an interest in working with people with disability or impairment. One of my friends actually started the para-athletics program, and he was resigning so he could finish his PhD. I kind of just got lucky timing that they needed someone else to coach, so that someone else ended up being me.
So what drew you to coaching para-athletics?
I mean, I really love the sport of track and field because I really enjoyed when I was an athlete in it. And it's just kind of a nice way to be back in the world of track and field without actually having to do it. Pretty much any sport that is run in the non-disabled world also runs, has a para program. So like I said, we just do para track and field and para swimming at the Stedward Center, but everyone kind of knows about wheelchair basketball. But if you're watching the Winter Olympics right now, there's tons of things with para skiing, para snowboarding, sledge hockey is really cool, wheelchair curling, wheelchair rugby, things like that. Most sports have a para counterpart as well.
Do you think that's something that the Stedward Center would want to have in the future?
I think that would be really neat, especially things like cross-country skiing, which is really similar to actually if you're a wheelchair racer, you would ski in a similar way. So, and as individual sports are a little easier to run because you don't need a whole team of people with a similar impairment type.
Is that a difficulty often, is finding people who have similar impairments?
It can be. If you think of something like wheelchair basketball, we do have teams in Edmonton, but they also pull from surrounding areas. So some people are driving from rural towns like 2 hours to come to practice or things like that. So
that's quite the commitment to the sport.
Yeah, definitely.
You once helped build some wheelchairs for your athletes.
I joke that when I started this position, I also became a wheelchair mechanic because it was just something I never really thought about. You know, when I did track, I just put on my running shoes or my racing spikes and went out. But yeah, we've dealt with popped tires, one of our tires cracked, we've pads go missing or break, and last year, right before high school provincials, we had an athlete from Calgary who really wanted to try the sport. She'd actually just been doing track and field in a basketball wheelchair. And we had to kind of put together a chair. I had some wheels from one chair and a frame from one and all the pads off another one that we literally put together the night before her race. So,
wow, that's incredible that you pulled that off.
It was a little stressful, but all worked out.
So for the Stedward Center, do you have to be a university student to access it, or can anyone, in theory, access it?
It's a community facility, so we do have university students, but a lot of our members are children, so not in university yet, or adults as well. It's part of the Faculty of Kinesiology, Sport and Recreation, but it's kind of its own separate program as well.
And where on campus is it located?
So it's in the Van Vliet building, and when the new gym opened up in Van Vliet, the Stedward Center moved into the old space.
Oh, okay. Well, if anyone's listening and didn't know where the Stedward Center is, now maybe they will be able to access it. So what is therapeutic recreation, and what ways can recreation be used as a therapy, if I'm understanding it correctly?
So as a rec therapist, I think I have probably the coolest job in the world. So where I work right now at the Glenrose, I have a stroke caseload. So all my patients have had a stroke and they're now back in their homes or community. And basically my job is to get them connected with whatever leisure recreational activities they would like to do. So we do a lot of exercise or sports-based programs, but we also do aquatics, art skill development, music therapy, even just like socialization or coffee groups could fall under us. And the point of these are, there's kind of twofold. So if you look at something like an arts class, it could be to help someone, you know, retrain maybe a hand that's lost some function because they now have to hold a pencil in it or practice fine motor skills. And then the other view is that by engaging in something that you really enjoy as a leisure activity, you'll get a lot of benefits from that. You know, you can find meaning, you get to challenge yourself, you're choosing to do the activities. Kind of the mental health side of that is really important as well.
Has rec therapy been a more recent program, or has this existed for multiple years?
It's kind of an interesting one. It originally, I guess, started in America kind of after the World War, when we had a lot of veterans coming back that couldn't necessarily return to their jobs or the job that they used to do because of an injury. And people kind of realized that, well, they need something to do with their time. So it's kind of evolved from that. It's kind of a North American phenomenon as well. I think it has different names in different countries, but depending where you go in the world, it might exist in healthcare settings or it might not.
Have you, as part of your studies, looked at other places and what they are doing and potentially what we can learn from other countries?
Yeah, part of my thesis work, I look at a lot of American studies and how America is actually influencing Canadian therapeutic recreation. But there's some pretty cool things in Japan, actually, is really strong therapeutic recreation. And in Australia, they call it diversional therapy, but it is kind of the same basis as well.
So you talked a little bit about the different models of viewing disability, and you said that one of the models is a social model of disability, that our society constructs the disability. Mm-hmm. Are there different models of disability that you could mention as well?
Sure. So the medical model and the social model, I guess you could kind of say, sit on opposite ends of a continuum. So in the medical model, it really views, they don't really have a distinction between impairment and disability, and it's just kind of seen as a really negative thing that hopefully medicine can fix for you. So rehabilitation tends to follow a medical model because their goal is to have someone's functioning return to what it was, you know, before an injury or illness. So then on the other side is the social model, which, you know, thinks that if society was more inclusive, we could really reduce what they consider disablement of people. So a lot of the problems that people with impairments face is just because places aren't accessible for them and things like that. There's also like the rights-based model, which is kind of similar to the social model, that they really just push for people with impairment to have the same rights as someone without.
So what would be an example of a right that someone doesn't have in a space right now?
There's lots. So actually right now in Nova Scotia, there's a legal battle going on. Some people with impairment are living in kind of an institution, and they want to have the right to live in their own homes and manage their own care. So that's a big one. Lots of things with employment also, that employers don't always have to make accommodations for someone to be able to do their job, even access to school, access to being able to vote, things like that.
Those are all really interesting things that I probably wouldn't have thought about that other people don't have access to.
Yeah, I think really until you kind of meet someone who's had some of these challenges or, you know, even read about them in the news, it's, you kind of assume that all these things, you know, it's 2018, we should all have access to them, but there's still battles being fought all the time.
I guess this leads into another question I had for you. Was what do you think are a lot of common misconceptions that people have about disability?
You know, I think the biggest one is just that people are really often uncomfortable around people with impairment just because they think that they're different or weird, or, you know, they might think that they're not as smart as them or that they're not able to do things. But even in the class that I teach, it's often in my students' first time working directly with someone with an impairment, and they always seem to come back and say, like, wow, like, this person is just like someone else that I, you know, like, they're just like my mom. They're the same age, and they say kind of the same thing. So it's not that, you know, everyone with a disability is like, oh, it's just like everyone else. But, you know, they are just people, and it's not a big scary thing that kind of sometimes people have that assumption.
Would you also say that, this is going back to the issue about rights, people have a misconception about maybe like the lack of access also?
I think so. One of my sisters had a baby recently, and so she has the stroller with her a lot. And she said she never realized how many places have stairs until, you know, you're carting the stroller around. So even if we think about something like the LRT, which is supposed to be accessible, you know, the number of times I've seen people waiting in the accessible waiting spot, or maybe the elevator's broken, and what do you do when you get off at the train station and you can't take the stairs and the elevator is broken, right? So it's a big problem for sure.
I also think about in winter as well, how much more difficult it becomes to navigate.
Yeah, for sure. That's why for a lot of disabled people, having community mailboxes was a real problem, because in the winter they might not actually be able to go get their mail because it's too hard to get through the snow. Like, if I think where mine is, I have to cross a road. Like, those things that people kind of take for granted or think, oh, it's not that hard, you know, for someone that could literally be impossible to do.
Have you come across anything about access for rural populations at all? Because I just, in this conversation, I'm thinking, oh, okay, you know, we're in urban centers, there's more accessibility, more programs, but what about people who live in rural communities?
Yeah, it's really tough if you don't live in a big city. In both my jobs, as a rec therapist and coaching, for coaching right now, I'm in contact with probably 3 or 4 athletes who don't come to my program because they live 3 hours away, but there's also nothing for them in their community. So that gets really tricky. And then the Glenrose acts as a rehab hospital for people for all over Alberta and also even the territories, because they don't have a big hospital like that. So it can be really tough if you have someone from like Fort Chipewyan, because when you send them home, they're not going to have access to all these programs. So you really have to find things that either they can do independently or what they could maybe do with their family or things like that. But it's definitely a lot more difficult. Like, if I have someone who lives downtown, I'm like, oh, yes, like, they can take the LRT to the YMCA, they can go to this program, and then you get someone who lives out in Devon who maybe doesn't drive anymore, and it's a lot more challenging.
Do you see that as an area that the provincial government could potentially invest in? Is more of these kind of programs in rural communities or more northern communities?
I definitely think so. I mean, I love physical activity, so I will always be an advocate for it. But, you know, if you're going to put a rec facility in anywhere, you know, why not just make it accessible? Because that's going to, you know, mean a section of the population is going to be able to access it as well. And that section of the population, you know, whether they're elderly or have some kind of impairment, then that's able to keep them healthier. You know, there's a lot of benefits for that as well.
Great. So I think that's all the time we have for today. Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you wanted to add?
No, I think that's everything.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks so much, Megan, for coming in and chatting with us. And thanks for your time.
All right. Thank you.